Hi, this is Phil Lairness, sitting alongside my wife, Lily Lairness. As we travel through the third decade of the 21st century, it's good to know that the Midweek Drive and Midweek Drive Morning Editions continue to produce a minimum of 4 hours of weekly audio goodness on Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com.
It's always nice when we get a kind of family fortunes aspect of the Midweek Drive. I mean, Tessa Snart and her mum, Annie, of course, very regular from that point of view. We've had a whole heap of other folk. Obviously, Malcolm Tomlinson and Eleanor Tomlinson. And now we actually welcome Gabriella and Jonathan Van Jennings. Gabriella, of course, a relatively recent Midweek Drive out, but she's brought her dad along, which is great. Jonathan, welcome to the Midweek Drive. How are you?
Very good. You're not going to ask all sorts of general knowledge questions, Alex, are you, by any chance?
No, Philip. I haven't even introduced you as yet. But, you know, our survey said, Anyway, Jonathan, welcome to the Midweek Drive. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good, excellent. Jonathan's here because, Philip, he's quite a fan of Annette André. And what a fine individual wouldn't be. So there we are. It's
well,
all great.
Indeed.
So what, pray tell, Philip, have you been getting up to over the last few days? What exciting voiceover material have you been doing?
Well,
what production
yes.
stuff? Share with us.
I did a really exciting training film, a narrated one, which is bread and butter, and nothing wrong with that. And we're working on a children's story website called superbooks.com. And so we're writing an awful lot of stuff. Well, I'm writing an awful lot of stories for that, which I shall then, when they've all gone through the process of having the illustrations done by our team of illustrators, we'll then move on to recording them and doing the voices and narrating the children's stories. And it's just lovely to do it. we've got some lovely feedback from children as well. So that's
and clearly nothing to do with minestrone, tomato, mushroom, or indeed chicken. These are super books which you can't eat, you should read, because it's good, nourishing, intellectual material.
Well, thank you, Alexis. You've absolutely hit the nail on the head there. Now, you're quite right. They are nourishing. And what we've found is an awful lot of the old children's stories, like the kind of, you know, the Hans Christian Andersen, the Brothers Grimm, they were grim. I mean, they were really quite ghastly stories. I mean, they were, because, you know, you'd end up with children, you know, but the characters often dying and going to heaven and, you know, worse. I mean, all sorts of horrible injuries and deaths.
We've turned it around and we've lended
so that each story ends with a kind of a reward for decency, kindness, humanity, consideration, so that the children kind of learn those kind of moral lessons from the stories.
Oh,
I see myself as a latter-day Enid Blyton, really.
I would have put you more into Aesop's category, but in these transgender days...
We've done those too, yes. We've reversioned those.
Let's turn to Jonathan Van Jennings. Jonathan,
yes.
What fairy stories or tales did you actually provide Gabriella with when she was growing up? Or was it just a case of, no, she's just going to have to wait until she goes to the University of Lincoln to learn stuff?
Well, I wouldn't want to try and challenge academia too much, so we might have left it with that.
So what were her favourites?
There's a story hanging in there somewhere, yeah. I think.
what were her favourite children's stories?
Oh, children's stories. I liked Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah, I think ones. And the,
I think
a Thomas
the
Tank Engine.
Yeah, Thomas I was a big fan of.
Yeah.
So you like
I think
Thomas.
It was my encouraging, I think, that one.
I think we're joined by further
Nothing
people.
Nothing wrong with Thomas the Tank Engine, as indeed I'm sure Annette André would actually say. Welcome, Annette, to your regular slot. But this time it's kind of interactive, really, from that point of view. How's San Diego at present?
Well, the sun's come out now. It was a bit grey, but we're having, you know, warm weather, cool nights, cool mornings, but nice weather.
Wow, very
As pleasant. Opposed to a lot of other parts of the country and the world.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is, Annette, as you know, as a regular Midweek driver, so, you know, you have to have essentially quality weather. That's what Jessica Burtis would obviously maintain. Isn't that right, Jessica? She's just unmuting herself. She's okay now.
You're back,
wonderful pregnant pause there. Annette, I'm delighted to introduce another one of your many, many, many fans who was so impressed with the fact that you were going to be on this slot that he even asked his daughter, Gabriella Van Jennings, could he please, please have the opportunity to meet the original genie from, of course, Randall and Hopkirk Deceased? It's Jonathan Van Genians. How, I mean, so Jonathan, Annette, Jonathan.
Hello.
Hello.
Good to meet you.
Jonathan, would you like to put a question to Annette now regarding that series? It's okay, now I have clarified this is the original and best Randall and Hopkirk Deceased, as opposed to that latter-day incarnation with Vic and Bob.
So, yes, very, quite.
Very important.
I have a more general question, actually. You've appeared in some of the most, dare I use the word, iconic TV series of the 60s and 70s. Many, I mean... The Prisoner, The Persuaders, The Brothers, I can name loads more, but what was your favourite one?
Oh, out of all of them, obviously. That's the first time I've had that question out of all of them. Well, I loved working on The Saint, not for the work, but I loved working with Roger because it was great fun. But I enjoyed working on, obviously, Randall and Hopkirk, because that was really something. I did not enjoy The Prisoner.
Don't go there, Jonathan. That's all I'll say. Just do not go down the Rhine of The Prisoner. It's Patrick McGowan at his worst. Or better still, read Annette's autobiography.
Right.
Well, I don't know. I don't think anything stands out in my mind. There was one which you probably never heard of. It was a series called Mickey Dunn with Dinsdale Landon. I think it was BBC, I think. And I just did an episode in that, but we really worked very well together. And it was it just did something to me, and I enjoyed it very much. And that's one that always pops into my mind. But there were a lot of others, and I enjoyed doing all them because I love working.
I see. You were in The Avengers, I believe, and The New Avengers.
I was in The Avengers, and that was nice to do because I worked only with Patrick, and he was just wonderful to work with. He was just lovely. And we worked together again. I think he had something that pulled out of you what you needed to have. And The New Avengers, that I didn't enjoy. I did not enjoy The New Avengers.
Was it just Gareth Hunt? Was it something to do with Gareth? Or was it just a case of, no, just put him to one side?
No, it wasn't to do with Gareth, actually.
Okay.
I'm more feminine.
You're trying to get some gossip out of her, aren't you? I can sense it, Alex.
Still, I mean, I was just going to clarify Patrick McNee, not Patrick McGowan, and also Patrick McNee, not to be confused with Patrick McGee, because these are critical things,
oh,
you know.
Yes, yes, exactly. I did work with Henry McGee.
Oh, yes, the Northern Irish actor.
Henry was wonderful.
Yeah. Annie Hill used to say exactly the same thing. Jonathan, before we introduce Pamela Sue Mann, can I just inquire your accent, Jonathan? Where are your roots in the world?
Well,
it doesn't sound like Suffolk. That's all I'm saying.
Well, it confuses a lot of people. I have been mistaken for an Australian on occasion, but actually, what it is, I was actually born in Chelmsford in England.
I thought I could hear a Chelmsford accent there.
But my mother was from Boston in America.
Ah.
And my father is from Lancashire. But I went to school at an American air base, even though it was in England. And that's the result is the way I speak, which confuses a lot of people.
That underlies, you can hear that underline, much more than Australian.
I think Chelmsford is coming through very strongly here. I mean, all the time. I'm just hearing Chelmsford. I can't hear anything else.
That's very true. We'll go over to Gloucestershire and actually say Hannah O'Brien. Firstly, congratulations, Hannah. Would you like to share the tremendous, successful fundraising marathon that you've recently completed in aid of Mind?
Oh, yes. Well, not quite a marathon. It was 10 kilometres I ran for Mind, and I've raised £660, which is fantastic. But hi, everyone.
Well done, Hannah O'Brien, proving, Gabriella, that good journalism graduates can still actually be good for the community as well, even though she's still working on that peanut butter for Jessica. It'll happen, Jessica. Don't worry. You're closer to Britain now. Pamela, we'll come to you now. Pamela, the team obviously all assembled here. We have father and daughter, Jonathan and Gabriella Van Genians. We have Hannah O'Brien. We have Annette Andre, Philip Hurdwood and Jessica Burtis. What question would you like to put to the team or any individual? It's over to you, Pamela.
Okay, I have a team question. It's forming right now. Okay, what is the thing on your mind at the moment that you'd like to share? Could be anything.
I'd like to talk about a radio show that I'm doing at the moment. Hold on a minute. I am doing a radio show.
good self-reflexivity there. On the ball.
Well, you know, that was a performance, that was. I mean, that's BAFTA worthy, that one.
Jessica, we missed you earlier today. We thought you'd left us, but here you are, back in force.
Yeah, sorry. I love this like sandwich here that I don't get in the US. It's like egg and cress. And I had a bad sandwich and it like made me feel absolutely awful. And then I decided to try it again because I was like, maybe it was a fluke. And I was sick all yesterday and today. So no more sandwiches for me. Goodness. Sorry about that.
Did you buy them from? Where did you buy it from?
I don't know, because I used to get them from Tesco and they were like really good. But then my boyfriend's mom picked me up a couple that I hadn't had before. And they did not agree with me. I felt so nauseous. And I went on like a drive yesterday with my boyfriend and his dad. But like Irish roads are so twisty and thin, and they like Irish people, like they go like 60 miles per hour down those things. So I felt like I was on a roller coaster and it did not help. I just woke up at like 6:30.
The plus factor,
maybe
Jessica.
It wasn't the sandwiches. Maybe it wasn't the sandwiches. Maybe it was the road that you were on. Caused the upset, I reckon. Something like that.
Or a combination of both of those. Egg and cress sandwiches and Irish roads. I mean, that's got to be another album title, Pamela, surely. You know,
my
time as an egg sandwich, you know.
She's writing it down, Alex, so you can tell.
Very, very critical. Thank heavens, Hannah, you didn't send over the peanut butter, otherwise she could have actually put those to bed as well. just shows. Hannah, what's on your mind?
Goodness, what's on my mind? I'm back in the office now, back to almost normality. Just wondering how everyone else is doing with their road to freedom or not.
I like that. Roads to freedom or not. And Gabriella, only a matter of weeks now before you return to Lincoln and we have full face-to-face scenarios, social distancing gone possibly for the foreseeable future. Are you looking forward to that, or is it a case of I won't be able to handle this, actually seeing people not on a computer screen?
No, I'm so looking forward to going back and hopefully face-to-face, and like virtually will be a thing of the past, hopefully. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to going back. That's the thing that's on my mind, is just packing, like just trying to pack everything in the suitcase. Like my dad's really good at it because he's just sort of like, yeah, just chuck this in.
I mean,
is anybody nervous about, you know, going back to real life and meeting people in the flesh and all that and doing going on public transport? I am. I mean, I've had two or three meetings I was meant to go up to London to attend. And I said, can we do it by Zoom? You know, that worked because I was nervous about being on the underground.
Yeah. Philip, what you need to say there is I'd like to do it by Zoom because it's more sustainable for the planet. I don't have to add to the carbon footprint by travelling all the way to London to actually do that.
That was implied, Alex. That was implied, of course. But you're quite right. No, it is. It's you know, we hope that it's going to reduce air miles. People used to fly across all over the place and do it. But I think
just for an egg sandwich, you know.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. But people's work patterns have completely changed. People are thinking, I don't need to go on the motorway for an hour and a half. I don't need to spend thousands of pounds every year on travelling by train up to London or any other city, you know. And I think it's changed things for the good, and that is no bad thing.
Although I don't know, there was something wonderful about citizens of North Carolina who'd get on the jet, fly across to Ireland, pick up an egg sandwich, fly all the way back again. It's like David Frost.
I don't know what you're talking about, Alex. I have no idea.
It's a very good topic of conversation because I think an egg and cress sandwich you can't beat. You cannot beat an egg and cress sandwich.
And never let it be said, Annette, that in the absence of an Annette Andre audio missive, we can't bring out the egg and cress sandwiches, which is the ultimate sort of line. It's very important for that sort of.
Well, we'll tell you what, here's a thought. When we all gather in the actual studio and do a live broadcast, Alex will be providing a bumper plate of egg and cress sandwiches.
Yeah, it's a possibility.
Will you not, Alex?
I think we'll need to negotiate over that one. Pamela, are you nervous about getting back onto the... I mean, obviously, Jerry's already started. What are your own thoughts on this one?
I mean, it's embarrassing to say, but New York is just... You know, it's business as usual with mask, you know, and people aren't wearing masks outside. And I just took the subway with my daughter last night. And quite late back, and it was fine. In fact, my friend is nervous about her son being, you know, in the big bad city. And even though he's at NYU and it's very safe, and his dorm is like literally right there, right at the park, completely safe. So we walked him to his, because he's brand new there, you know, we walked him right to his dorm room where a really cute girl said, "Hey, Archie." And so we knew he was fine, everything's good. And then Faye and I walked on. And I decided that, because I knew my friend Donna was nervous, so I was texting her, look, and I was taking some photos to let her know that everything was safe and fine. And then we got into the subway and I started taking some photos. And Faye completely lambasted me with good reason. She's like, "That's just creepy. You just don't take photos of people on the subway." But of course, I was just thinking about my friend and I wanted her to know that her son was completely safe. And so I didn't.
And after all, Pamela, you couldn't really admit to actually taking photographs for your friends in the Kremlin, could you? You know, let's be honest. You know, it's important.
In the Kremlin? Good heavens.
So yeah, it's business as usual pretty much here. You know, I think New Yorkers and New Yorkers, they just want to keep on and they don't, you know, they've got to make that meeting. They've got to do that thing. It's capitalism, you know. So Jessica knows, you know, it's I think the trepidation, it's that was this summer when we were just sort of coming back. I think now we're sort of doing it already.
Annette, does this connect with yourself? I mean, are San Diego people as fearless as we always knew that they secretly are?
Well, I don't go into San Diego very much at all because it's about 30 minutes away. So. And that's, I don't know, that may be slightly different. But where we are, it seems to be, it's quiet, but also people on the whole seem to be reasonably careful. You know, I started maybe a few weeks ago to start venturing into the odd store to do a bit of shopping or something. I wear two masks, not just one, but two. And I go at times when I know it's not going to be really crowded. You know, everybody's rushing to get in there. If I see too many people, I don't bother going. It's been pretty okay, actually. I don't go on trains or buses or stuff. We drive everywhere here and go walking. And it hasn't phased me. It's been nice to get out and actually move and see things in stores, and you can feel them and see them. And I online is driving me mad. You know, I order something, rather it comes, I look at it, and I say, "Oh God," and I send it back. So, I mean, things are going back all the time. I think we're a lot better here. Los Angeles is different because there it goes up and down like a yo-yo in terms of opening, closing. You know, they're always sort of having wild parties and it all flares up again, as it is doing in most of the country. I mean, it's scary over here, but we are in a little area, which is lovely, but it seems a bit safer I think, than some of the others. I would not like to be in the South, and I would not like to be up in South Dakota now, where it's, I don't know if you know anything about it, but it is out of whack again.
Without being political, we certainly have heard all the...
Well, it wasn't political, it's just medical at the moment. It is political
because there are certain states that are, you know, not going ahead with mandatory vaccination or any kind of vaccination or
whatever. Absolutely.
That becomes political, and those states are run by one party, where, you know, other states which have lower case loads are, you know, run by
absolutely.
Well, that's without being political. This is the family show. Let's face
exactly.
It. Father and daughter here, for heaven's sake, let's respect that.
Precisely, and let's face it, we're so blessed in Britain to actually have a wonderful uniformity in terms of our politicians, who we know always have our best interests at heart.
Of course they do, Alex. Of course they do.
Very important, especially the new Secretary of State for Education. I'm sure.
The man is a genius. I mean, I think the future of our children is safe in his hands.
Exactly. So, Jonathan, if memory serves, were you one of the crucial critical workers? Did you work throughout the pandemic system, or what's your own experience been as a parent of a child who had to sort of do all her stuff online over the last few months and so on? What's it been like for yourself?
Well, in some ways, it was nice to have her back at home after she'd been away at university. It was a shock to have her not here when she first went. Sort of the empty house and the quiet empty house.
You had to get all the bunting and take it all down when she came back.
So it was. I was furloughed fairly soon after the pandemic started, and I was furloughed for about 4.5 months, and it was. Strange, because we live in a small village, Bury St. Edmunds, in the middle of Suffolk, which is a rural county in East Anglia in England. And we didn't go out very much. And it was sort of, it's hard to describe, sort of almost an eerie calm in some ways. Everything was very quiet. There was very little traffic. It was like a strange calm, really, until you put the news on, of course. You heard the dreadful stories about, you know, 1,000 people a day dying and things like that, and how bad it was in other places. But it seemed sort of unnatural calm here for a time. Then sort of things very gradually got moving again. I mean, Gabriella went back to university in September last year. I returned to work on shortened hours in August. And it sort of very slowly got moving again. Obviously there were other lockdowns, but they didn't seem to have quite the impact that the first lockdown in the UK had, which was, I think, taken more seriously by everybody, the first lockdown than the subsequent lockdowns.
It was clearly the use of those Rover weather balloons, as manifested, of course, in The Prisoner, and, of course, longtime favourites of Jessica Burtis, that kept everybody in the area of Bury St Edmunds, that clearly worked on that system. And again, it's a rhetorical question. I used to ask this to a colleague who ended up teaching in Bury St Edmunds. Why haven't they as yet? You know, what has St Edmunds ever done to actually not be buried? I mean, surely by now, centuries the place has been going. Why haven't they buried St Edmunds? How do you say that?
Well,
I come to Bury St Edmunds not to praise it. That's Shakespeare's.
a nice touch of the Caesars there.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you don't call me Eyed for nothing.
So. You're an honourable man, no doubt.
Indeed, very honourable. Indeed, you've been brushing up.
Our faults lie not in ourselves or not in our stars, but in ourselves. That's the critical thing. Let's move on from Brutus and Cassius to Hannah.
I think probably a sensible decision.
I mean, back to normality, what's it like with respect to your world of food, nutrition, and so on? And any sort of slight uncertainties? And running the marathon, was it socially distanced? Or half marathon, or indeed 10K?
It was all very well done, yes. So everything outside, obviously, so socially distanced where you can. Depends how fast you're running, whether you can run further away from the others in the race, I guess. And with work, everything's flowing as normal, working in food and having the issues with the the drivers getting food to stores is an issue.
This, of course, Annette, you may have actually heard that Britain will shortly be suffering not only a shortage of egg sandwiches, but indeed a lack of shelving space to actually store the egg sandwiches on. So,
well, it's the Cress workers I feel sorry for. I mean, it's just no Cress left anywhere. You look for Cress, you look on this shelf, no Cress, look on the other shelf, not a trace of Cress, yeah. Not a wisp, not a little green shoot to be found.
Yeah, quite literally a Cressless society.
Cressless. Absolutely, yeah. Cressless. And it's heartbreaking. It is heartbreaking.
Indeed. I mean, Annette, your daughter's obviously still over here. Do you get the vibe in terms of how Britain's surviving, that we're still plucky Britannia battling against the joys of Boris and his friends?
I think she tries to stay away from the politics as much as possible.
I think that could be said, certainly.
Which I thoroughly applaud, as I do.
From the job, I think, as and, well.
And because she's, you know, she's been working from home all this time too, I think she goes back to the office maybe once a week or something. But she's got two kids, one of 12, one of 10. I think they've now just gone back to school. And, I mean, her life is they've been... She doesn't, they don't really go traveling. They do if they can drive, and they'll camp a bit. They'll camp for a few days or do something like that. And they'll maybe go with out of their little, what they call their bubble of friends. They'll sometimes go with a few of those, but it's not very often. And she just shops locally. I think she's not having to race into town on the underground, what do you call it over there? The underground.
Underground, yeah.
The tube, or buses or things. So her husband has had to go away. He's had to go on business over to Latvia, I think it is, several times. So he was a bit nervous, apparently, going the first time, but he seems to have weathered it very well.
A lot of very influential people from Latvia, of course. Latvia is a place where a lot of people, famous people, come from. Isn't that right, Pamela?
There you go. Pamela, still muted, but I'm sure she'll unmute in a few seconds.
Unmuted.
Yes, some secretly very famous people are from Latvia.
Which also ties in, of course, to great railway journeys and a feature that we'll be running after this initial programme, the impact the railways have actually had. So very quickly, do we have a favourite railway station or part of the land where you actually say, this is worthwhile? It could be Grand Central, it can be Lincoln, it could be Saltburn, it could be... do you have a favourite railway station and why? Annette? Any favourite railway station?
Grand Central Station
is
just terrific. It's wonderful.
It's got,
is that where the Oyster Bar is?
Yes.
There, that's right. We'll just ask for that.
Yes.
It's heaven.
Absolutely. And they do a wonderful, wonderful soup there, don't they? You can get a nice hot soup there.
Yes, they do.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's great. I love it.
Which I've heard actually has got various spin-offs in children's books and audio things called Super... No, sorry, it's an early piece. Gabriella, famous or favourite railway stations? I mean, Bury St Edmunds, Ipswich?
I mean, apart from Lincoln, obviously, I like, is it London Liverpool Street? Because it's got like a McDonald's in there. And like, when I used to go to London sometimes, we just used to go in there and just grab a McDonald's because it was quite handy.
Yeah. Not great food, but obviously I used to use the Liverpool Street Station when I commuted from Cambridge to London back in the days of setting up Cambridge University Radio. All fun. Jessica, favourite railway stations?
So I didn't get to go to many when I was in England because it was cut short, sadly, but I had a lot of fun every time I went to Sheffield because there was a pigeon there with one foot that I would always see, and I would just hang out with him whenever I was waiting for the train. I almost got stranded there one night too, and like that was terrifying, but
Well, you had the pigeon for company, of course.
Yeah, I had the pigeon. I did have him. He was with me. But I had a woman help me at like last minute when I ran to her, like, almost crying, and was like, where's the station? And she, like, no hesitation, stood up and, like, pointed me this way. And she's my British godmother now. She doesn't know it, but, you know, she was, like, the fairy godmother I needed at the moment. But, yeah, I hope that one-footed pigeon is doing great. I miss him.
I mean, I'm sure we need to work on a musical of the one-footed pigeon. Did you actually name the pigeon at all? Did you catch the pigeon? We know, obviously, you wouldn't want to shoot the pigeon.
Hopalong, I suppose goodness. You could call it, really.
I have a story of a pigeon, which is interesting, because we used to live in Battersea, right near the park there, and Arthur used to walk the dog a lot. We did, you know, but or we'd go together, but he used to walk. There were a lot of pigeons in the park, and there was a one-legged pigeon that, I don't know, every time Arthur walked into the park, he knew, and the pigeon would be there and would fly along with him going through the park. Or, you know, I mean, I was there too a lot of the time, so I saw it. But that pigeon knew every time that Arthur came into the park.
And obviously, when you and Arthur went to New York or went back to New York, clearly, Annette, that pigeon decided, I'm off to Sheffield. There's nowhere else for me to go.
There you are. It commuted.
It must have been.
Yeah. Pamela, any other burning questions you'd like to raise with the team in the remaining moments we have?
Not the burning question. The burning question.
Of our time.
No, you know what that means. If I ask the question and we get the answers, then you know what that means, Alex.
That's true. That is very true. So anyway, let us motor on from that point of view. Philip, how long will we have to wait before we can listen to these super tales? What's
they're
the
all
schedule?
Online right now. They're all online right now.
And the how can we find them online?
If you type in superbooks.com, S-O-O-P-E-R, books.com, all one word, superbooks.com, it's all there. And if you've got any little children, then please sign them up. Or you can actually use some free stories as well. We have a subscription service, which is minimal. But we ourselves as a kind of Netflix for children's stories, really. And so that's coming along beautifully. And we're very happy with the feedback we're getting from people. Have you got this thing up on screen now, Alexius?
We have Magical Stories Made with Love, award-winning digital stories and audiobooks for 3 to 9-year-olds, direct from our family to yours.
Absolutely.
I mean, you've got The Candy King, you've got Charlie Bryce, you've got The Fast Lane, you can have 5 amazing stories and audiobooks free.
Free.
Honestly.
At the point of service, we can do this for you. And, you know, we've got lots of, good stuff on there. We keep adding stories, usually 1 or 2 a week we keep adding, which I have to write and narrate. But we've got quite a few which we're still drip feeding in. So, yeah.
And I'm sure, Philip, that the inspiration from today, a one-legged pigeon and his hunt for the perfect egg and cress sandwich.
I think that's the bare bones of a story. I think it's the bare bones. And I think I'm going to build on that. So watch out for Hopalong the pigeon and his endless search for the ultimate sandwich.
So actually, Philip, as indeed we in many ways are the founding parents of this little thing, being broadcasters back in the day in the 1980s, would you like to go around the team and ask the last 2 questions? Off you go, Monsieur Herbert.
I certainly will. Now I will certainly start with Annette. Have you enjoyed the show so far?
Yes, I certainly have.
And when you are asked, not if you're asked, when you're asked, would you like to come back again?
I would love to.
There was hesitancy there, I noticed, Alex.
Satellite delay, Phil. Satellite delay.
Satellite delay. And so, Hannah, would you, I'll ask you the same question. Have you had fun today?
Always. Always,
good, good.
Always.
And you will definitely be back when asked.
Of course.
Wonderful, wonderful. And you guys up there, up in Chelmsford? I should say. Can I ask you the same question? Have you had fun?
Yes, thank you.
Yes, definitely.
And you will definitely be invited back, I'm quite sure. And would you come back again?
Yes, definitely.
I bet my dad would like to as well.
Excellent. Well, that would be fantastic. I'm glad you were able to speak for him. That's fantastic. Jessica, you are somebody who...
I don't actually know. I wouldn't know how to do it without it.
Well, there you go. Jessica is a familiar face. And of course, I'm sure you've had fun. I hope you have. And I'm sure you'd love to come back again when asked.
Oh, yes. I've had so much fun as always. And I will stay away from the egg and cress sandwiches. So
absolutely. And the one-legged pigeons. Don't forget them. And Pamela, you would, if you had fun?
Always fun.
Excellent. I'm glad you've had fun. And would you come back for more fun when asked?
Yes, please.
Good. There you are, Alex. You have your answers. Would you come back again if we actually ask you?
These days, who knows what the situation
is. That's not certain,
exactly.
Alex.
Yeah, it's very true. We'll just have to wait and see. We're even talking about doing some more studio stuff. Who knows? Don't forget, you can also get PamelaSumanMusic.com to find out some of the awesome material that Pam's actually involved with. And for goodness sake, do not put it off any longer, because it's online as well as physically. Annette Andre, Where Have I Been All My Life? The memoir is still a... Is there going to be a sequel, Annette?
I don't think so.
This is an autobiography, I take it, Annette. Is that right?
Yes, a memoir, yes.
A memoir. Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
Yep.
You've got everything from Patrick McGoohan, not so nice. Benny Hill, interesting. Right the way through Zero Mustard. I mean, it's awesome. Wow. I mean, so many marvelous. And of course, most importantly, Arthur Weingarten. It's amazing. It's all coming together. So to Gabriella and Jonathan Van Genians, to Pamela Sue Mann, to Jessica Burtis, Annette Andre and Hannah O'Brien. And Philip, has it been okay for you?
I have thoroughly enjoyed myself, and invite me back when you dare.
Splendid. To Philip Hurdle as well. Keep on keeping on. And now we'll find out more about those great railway journeys and specialist railways experiences.
Sounding good.
It's back. It is back. And it's back for a third awesome series. Of course, the architecture the railways built. And this was so fantastic when we talked with the main man behind this. They had to bring it back. And we're delighted that he's back as well with the Midweek Drive. Tim Dunn, welcome to the Midweek Drive once again. How are you, sir?
I'm very good. Thank you for having me back again once again. It's really good to be here. It's a privilege. It really is.
No, a railway historian extraordinaire, architecture expert. And this is a wonderful series that puts both of those key things together in one wonderful package. I mean, anything that can actually go from Saltburn through Newcastle through a whole range of other sort of factors as well. And that's just the Northeast. I mean, I could talk about the Elbląg Canal in Poland, etc. This is going to be, I mean, I thought you'd actually raise the bar for the first two series, Tim, but this one looks as though you've taken it to a whole new level.
This is extreme railway travel, isn't it, really? It's kind of extreme building spotting. For this is a genuine delight, right? Because this is a programme about railways and buildings for people that might not think they like railways or buildings. And the whole point of this was to show people that perhaps the mundane, the everyday, the stuff you pass through or above or underneath actually is really worth just spending a little bit of time stopping off and going, this is actually really clever. Oh, this is really interesting. Yeah, because we speed through our lives, and perhaps COVID's taught us a little bit about how we stop off and just slow down a little bit here and there. We go on a train, you zap through things at 100 miles an hour, like I speak at things 100 miles an hour, but you go through a tunnel mouth and you don't stop and see it because you're going so fast. But actually we've stopped and we've gone, okay, where are the most interesting tunnel mouths or interesting tunnels in Britain? And it turns out, or indeed Europe, and there are some absolute crackers. So we stop off at one, the Bramhope Tunnel in Yorkshire. And it's designed as a great castle because the local landowner said, you must build me a castle if you come to my land. And so they create this wonderful thing with lockable rooms in there. And we get the keys. And you go and learn about how they built a tunnel in the 1840s. How do you build a tunnel through this great bedrock through Yorkshire? And how do you, what the challenges were? And people died doing this. But we have local people and local experts who come and explain the thing they're really proud of on an international scale, to an international audience. And I love that. And perhaps the stations that we all pass through, right, in Lincolnshire, that we might stop and go, that's fairly standard. I mean, on my list of things to do in the future is Lincoln Station, because, again, a glorious, glious station. Indeed, the good shed had been converted recently as well. I'll kind of look at that, because these things are fabulous constructions that we might take for granted. But what's great about this programme is you stop and we go, OK, you're the station master or the station manager. Like, why is it like that? And we get an expert in as well from Historic England. And they go, ah, it's this style because of this. And suddenly you are told about the things that you thought you knew about, and you get a whole new level of understanding of the world around you. And that's brilliant fun.
I was going to mention the Lincoln thing, but you've addressed that elephant in the room, because clearly that's fairly critical from that point of view. Much as I'd love to say that Newcastle is fantastic, Saltburn likewise. Yes. I mean, also, I'd throw in Middlesbrough, actually, which is well worth considering in terms of Victorian Station, which is a wonderful northeast sector. But this is, of course, something which we still use these points of terminus in the 21st century. They're still very much there. Many of them have been refurbished, they've been redeveloped and so on. But those fundamental rational reasons in terms of why they were there, and if you look at Newcastle Station, which the series starts off with, I believe, that is a phenomenal celebration of not only Victorian architecture, but also the powerhouse of the first industrial revolution, arguably.
Absolutely. I mean, Newcastle is one of those cities, I think, that is forgotten. It's being a railway city. You know, the Stephensons had their locomotive works there. I mean, we go to the works and have a look at it on the outside of it and show that this is a kind of a hotbed. It's a crucible of railway engineering. And the fact is that this whole city was kind of gearing up. And it kind of, I suppose, because of coal and steel and, you know, the coal fields particularly, are why it was the place here. It became such a great sort of industrial powerhouse. But there were exports there all over the world of locomotives, for example, as well. But, you know, we go and look at the high-level bridge in Newcastle, and we see the architecture that resulted from railways appearing as well. So Stephenson signed the great high-level bridge. You know, how do you get to train tracks across the top of this remarkable valley, a huge valley for the River Tyne, you know, to connect up London to Scotland via Newcastle? Well, they had to design this entirely new style of bridge, and a double-level bridge with a road underneath it as well, because to help fund it, they had to get people to pay on an ongoing basis. You know, it's wonderful to uncover the stories of early railways and also some of our most modern ones as well. So, you know, we actually go and look in one episode, we're going to look at the construction site of one of the world's oldest roundhouse at Curzon Street in Birmingham. And the guys at HS2 building the brand new station have uncovered this early example of a roundhouse where effectively it's a stable for iron horses. You know, so where they go at the night, they put the engines to bed like they are horses.
If it's good enough for Thomas the Tank Engine, then clearly it's going to be good enough for those Victorian predecessors as well.
Do you know, honestly, it is like you're in a Victorian, it's like looking at the base plate of what could be a model railway, Thomas the Tank Engine. You can imagine all the engines, like, all chat around the turntable at night. But again, it's these locations which are kind of being uncovered. And we mustn't think it's always a museum, because of course, you know, railways are not museums. Preserved ones are, that's great. But our national infrastructure is infrastructure. And what I like about this programme as well, that we've managed to go around the whole of the UK and Europe, and we've seen how those stations have changed over time. And whether they're grade 2 listed or whether they're grade 1 listed or perhaps they're just local landmarks, there's often a clever way of updating them and making them right for passengers now. Because, say, we don't live in a museum. We live in an operating world where we need to get people effectively, efficiently and, frankly, sustainably around the planet.
I noticed Poland crops up a number of times, which is always quite nice from that point of view. You even got the Aleksandrow-Kujawski link within the whole system there. Was that a conscious choice? Did you sort of think, yeah, Poland's been underrepresentative. It's been like the Saltburn of Europe in times past. Let's go there.
I'm going to suggest that to the Polish authorities, that they, as the new tourist slogan, perhaps it's Saltburn of Europe. It's interesting, actually. All of this was filmed during January, February and March of this year, during COVID lockdowns. And as you can probably imagine, that's tricky. Because
you had the trains to yourself, though. Let's face it, Tim.
I did, and it was partly wonderful doing that, but also very sad, because traveling around the places that you love, seeing them empty, is quite emotional. Because, you know, these stations were built to take thousands of people, yet no one's there using them, and that's quite sad for not just me, but also the staff as well. And you could tell they were so sad to be there when no one was there to use the stuff that they love, but they were so proud to then go, but you know what? I've got the keys. Look at this. But as you want to go to Poland. So Poland we chose because actually we could get access during the COVID times. It was safe to go to. It was responsible to go to. It was not responsible to say go to France. That would have been wrong. Even though we could do, we thought we shouldn't do it. So we didn't do that. We chose places that we could go between fairly easily, that were had limited spaces and places, but also great stories. And so just because Poland has been off the railway map as it's for most tourists, doesn't mean it hasn't great stories. And so great architecture and great places, you'll find in all sorts of unusual things. Czechoslovakia, for example. I never thought I'd make a television programme about railway architecture in Czechoslovakia. But we found a
couple. Or the Czech Republic, to be politically correct.
Sorry, apologies. Czech Republic. Yeah,
there are Slovaks who might have sort of been going very annoyed at this particular moment. But there
you are. You're talking to a man with a geography degree here. I'm dreadful. I need a historian. It's interesting. We find places that are both beautiful, or fascinating, and interesting. They've got great stories and have wonderful, passionate experts that we could find to go, yeah, I want to come and tell the world about this, because you might not have heard of this before. Like the Elbe Canal in Poland. I mean, it's a railway line built to carry ships. That's extraordinary. I mean, one of the episodes down the line, you'll see this. And they put whole ships on the top of a railway and they carry it with a cable and take up this hill. I mean, it is genuinely bonkers. But this is the thing. You see around the world how railways have been used to create solutions to problems. And the problem here was, how do you get the ship from over here to over here, over a hill? Well, you put it on a train. Of course you do. Why not? Again, there's one tonight in Germany. We look at this funicular railway, a piggyback funicular, where they had to go, how do you take a train up a hill? Well, you could build a big spiral, a series of tunnels and loops and wonderful sort of contrivances. That would take forever. Let's just put it on top of a train and take it up sideways. You know, let's just do that. Of course you can. And that's what they do. And you see the stations behind it, and you see how they constructed it. And it, again, these wonderful stories. That's the joy of this. It's uncovering stories about places you thought you knew or had never heard of. And it's taking you in places that I hope inspire you to go and travel yourself sometime.
The first two series did exactly that. I have no reason to believe that the third one will be any different. And indeed, as I say, the bar will continue to be raised. How can people access the architecture the railways built to?
Well, it's on every Monday night at 8 o'clock on the Yesterday channel, which is on Freeview and Virgin Media and so on. It's very easy to find. It's also on UK TV Play as well. So the past two series, all 20 episodes of us rumbling around all of Europe's railways are on there. So 20 episodes of that. And the whole series as well, as it goes out, is on UK TV Play on the app and website as well.
And was there a particular favourite this time around for yourself? I mean, we shared, obviously, your line of the Czech Republic, Poland. I mean, obviously, I'm going to push Saltburn. But in terms of the sort of aspect, was it Margate that suddenly sort of thought, yeah, actually, that was quite a nice one for me?
Do you know, I'm a bit emotional in Saltburn, because it was so remarkable. And it's just and something I didn't know about this, right? Saltburn was created by the Stockton and Darlington Railway, which I knew about that. I knew a story about it. What I didn't expect was to find buildings like the promenade at the seafront actually built out of bits of old railway line. The railway company reused its stone block sleepers when they dismantled and put in wooden sleepers, and reused the same bits of stone to build new buildings. And that I find fascinating. And so there's surprising bits that are impressive. But the one I really love is actually close to home. I live in South London. And actually, the South London and Greenwich Railway Viaduct, which is still Britain's longest railway viaduct. It took 60 million bricks to build in 1836. So we're talking like early railways, London's first railway line. And it came in over the rooftops, and it's still doing the same job it did back then today. Now that is impressive. The biggest, the largest back then, it is still the biggest and largest, and it is still doing its same job, and it is still doing it perfectly well and enabling businesses underneath, like breweries and so on, to be underneath it and operate. And I think that's lovely. I think it's a lovely story.
It resonates into the future. Tim, two final questions for you. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic, well, Zoomer with us? Let's use the new technology. Has it been a good Zoomer for you today?
I've had a lovely Zoom with you. Thank you so much for having me. It's always a joy to talk to you. It's lovely to be able to share, and a privilege, I suppose, the passion that I've got, and also on behalf the teams we worked with around the UK and Europe, because honestly, there are so many wonderful stories about places we just didn't think you'd find interesting.
Sustainability, it's clearly the word probably of the 21st century, especially when it comes to obviously the planet and so on. And a recent survey suggests that we would be willing to pay over £600 more for sustainable furniture. So to talk us through some of the findings of this survey and indeed the importance of sustainability, we're delighted to welcome sustainable architecture and interior design expert, the fabulous Oliver Heath. How are you, Oliver?
I'm very good, Alex. Thank you for that. Yeah, so it's a really fascinating piece of research that's just come out from interiors retailer Heels. And, you know, it's demonstrating that actually younger age groups are really starting to change their consumer patterns and start to buy much more in line with their sense of environmental credentials and their kind of ethical beliefs. You know, for instance, you know, what they're saying is that actually more millennials, 65% than Gen Zs, would spend more money on a product for their home if it was better for the environment. And actually 58% of us would prefer to spend more money on a product for their home if it was better for the environment. So it is starting to show a real shift in thinking, not just about the wider environment, but also our own personal environments at home.
Obviously, cost is an important factor, but I see that durability and aesthetics are also important when it comes to the whole sort of system of what we're choosing for ourselves. I mean, I'm sort of still using furniture that my parents used, and it's still fundamentally found in terms of the sound, in terms of the dining room table and so on. Do you feel that we're heading towards a time where we don't chuck things out on a regular basis, unless, of course, it can be where they can be replaced by sustainability objects?
Yes, I mean, I think there is a, you know, a shift going on, you know, that I think older age groups, certainly like myself, were more used to kind of having hand-me-downs from people. But now what we're seeing is sort of younger age groups, people who are starting to rent homes, so the Gen Z who are between 18 and 24, and particularly the millennial groups who are between 25 and 34, are starting to shift their patterns away from kind of fast fashion, flat pack furniture, towards better quality pieces when they do get their homes. And you know, not just kind of buying more sustainable items by questioning those suppliers, but also wanting to buy more durable items that will last them for longer.
So is this bad news for Scandinavian furniture manufacturers who've been so used to flatbacks over the years that maybe they need to rethink their own game?
I think many of them are doing great things in the field of sustainability. But durability is not necessarily part of that mission. You know, they're buying very accessible, people, they're creating very accessible, fast-packed, low-cost furniture. But what this piece of research really shows is that age group between 25 and 34 have really put sustainability right up there at the top of the agenda. And part of that is about buying better quality, longer-lasting furniture. In part because, you know, that they're renting for longer. And then when they do finally get to buy their first homes, it's sort of making sure that they can take those pieces with them and enjoy them for longer. And I think part of that is recognizing that over the last 18 months, they've spent more time at home. Home is much, much more important than it used to be because they're not necessarily going out to work or going and socializing so much. So having a better piece of furniture is important. They're changing the way they think about consuming. They're not necessarily spending money on holidays or going to the theater or restaurants, and they're consuming much more sustainably, you know, in line with their ethics. And also realizing that there is a shift in their relationship with the environment, both in a short term, you know, that they like to go out and be in nature. And that in a way is a stepping stone to thinking about the conservation of our wider natural environment. So in a way, you know, there's a realization that people are kind of linking things together in what we call systems thinking, that everything is connected. Our decision to buy and consume things is going to have an impact on the environment, but also on our own lives.
The intentions are all good, but how in practice, Oliver, can people find out if products that they're intending to buy are indeed sustainable or not? Because one of the aspects, of course, of the joys of commerce is the classic phrase, caveat emptor.
Oh, what? I don't even know what that phrase is.
Buyer beware. Buyer beware. You might buy something that you think is sustainable and you might find it's not sustainable at all.
Well, I think that's all about doing your research before you buy. I think if you're going to buy a high ticket item, you should be doing your research. All the information is out there. But essentially, you know, some of the top things you can do is when you're buying a piece, make sure you ask your retailer, where does it come from? How is it created? Make sure that if it's a timber piece of furniture, that it's got the FSC label, which means that it's come from a sustainable, well-managed forestry source. You can also ask if the fabrics on that furniture are coming from an organic or fair trade background. Maybe they're made out of recycled materials from the fashion industry. If you're buying glass or aluminium, is it recycled from recycled materials? But also make sure that it's well made, that it's solid and durable. And I think spending a little bit more money, making sure that it has that solidity, means that you'll enjoy it more in your home because it won't wobble, the legs won't come off. And if you do have to move, then it'll come apart, go back together more times in a better way. Whereas I think with flat pack furniture, sometimes those fixtures and fittings can start to kind of wobble and come apart. And so actually it's far better to think in the long term and to buy one good solid piece than it is to buy three pieces that tend to fall apart over the same duration.
The future, Oliver. It's always difficult to look into the crystal ball, but do you feel if we, shall we say, look ahead to 2040, in which we're all driving electric cars and we're approaching that net zero carbon emission system from that point of view, do you feel as though actually our home environments will look drastically different from how they look at present? Or will it be a case of there might be a gradual shift to, as we've said, more sustainable internal furniture?
Well, as the saying goes, the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. You know, so these things can happen right now. You can lease electric cars, you can rent bits of furniture, you can buy better quality pieces of furniture. But looking into the future and kind of based on the trends that we're seeing right now, we are seeing an increase in interest and environmental awareness, which is exactly what this is showing, particularly from those new homeowners. We're seeing an interest in natural materials like wood and wool and cotton, and that making sure that they're coming from a sustainable source. We're seeing an interest in connecting with nature through those materials, but also in the introduction of plants and greenery, but also recognizing that making sure we're bringing in all those natural elements like natural sunlight and a connection to and the kind of elements of nature outside are really fundamental to the creation of happier and healthier places. And that's kind of an essential kind of more human-centered approach to that sustainability conversation. But, you know, all of that is basically embedded in what we're seeing in these trends right here, right now, that sustainability is moving up the agenda in the way we think about our homes.
And where would you suggest people could actually go to online to find out more details about the survey and indeed some of your own thoughts, Oliver, on this particular aspect?
So this a really fascinating piece of research that demonstrates that the environment is moving up the agenda and the way that we're thinking about our homes can be found at heels.com. So you can find that and also loads of durable, sustainable pieces of furniture.
Yeah, it's heels with an H as opposed to without the H, in which case it'll be an aquatic life form.
Exactly. It's definitely HEALS, H-E-A-L-S. Yeah,
absolutely. Oliver, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self. We'll wrap up with the two usual sustainable questions we always wrap up our Zoomers with. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
Well, it's been very sustainable because I've been in my office in Brighton speaking to you across the country. And so, you know, no carbon footprints associated with that travel. So it's been great and lovely to speak to you.
Exactly. I mean, I can't believe how primitive we used to be when we used to sort of get into cars, journey into a studio, work through that whole process. It just goes to show we can actually work on that basis. So on that premise, can we look forward to inviting you back again? Will you come back and return, Oliver Heath?
I would love to. I'd love to come back.